KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forums next hour, famed restaurant critic and food writer Ruth Reichel joins us to talk about her mother on this day after Mother's Day. Her recently published book, Not Becoming My Mother and Other Things She Taught Me Along the Way, is a meditation on the mother she discovered later in her adult life when she opened letters, notes, and journals her mother had kept for over 60 years. Ruth Reichel will join us in studio for an hour, which will include your calls and emails next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Ruth Reichel is presently editor-in-chief of Gourmet and author of three best-selling memoirs, Comfort Me with Apples, Tender at the Bone, and Garlic and Sapphire. She was editor of Gourmet Cookbook and was the restaurant critic for the New York Times and food editor and restaurant critic for the LA Times. She lives in New York City now, but used to live here in the Bay Area in Berkeley. And her newest book is a meditation, well, an excavation, really, as well as the paying of a debt she felt to her mother, Miriam, who left behind letters, notes, and journals from 1924 to 1988 that provided Ruth a view of a mother far different than the one she thought since childhood that she knew. Her mother and her mother's friends were smart, educated women who, as Ruth Reichel writes, had nothing to do. They were women of their time, and Ruth learned from her mother, especially as well as the other women, to live an authentic life of passionate involvement in the work she chose. Not Becoming My Mother and Other Things She Taught Me Along the Way is a loving tribute from a daughter for a mother she only began truly to understand once her mother had died. Ruth Reichel is a recipient of 4 James Beard Awards and numerous awards from the Association of American Food Journalists. And she joins us for this foreign hour. And so good to see you again.
It's really nice to see you.
Well, this is a journey for you, isn't it? I mean, this book was really not only a journey into the past, but a journey into your own inner life.
Yes, this has been. And oddly, as I'm on tour for the book now, and it continues. I mean, it's been the oddest 10 days for me as I go around talking about it, because it just gets deeper and I keep discovering more things the more I talk about it and hear other people's stories. So it has really been a remarkable journey.
Even discovered this morning that I knew some of your cousins and growing up near your cousins. You mentioned your mother's maiden name. It's going to always be dangerous to mention your mother's maiden name these days. But these were your mother was sort of a character in many ways. There were all these mim tales. Her name was Miriam, and mim tales were often comedic tales about things that she did and so forth. And then you discover a whole different person, and a whole different person than this comedic character. I mean, an extraordinary and multidimensional woman, really.
Yeah, it's it was a very odd thing to find out that this. I mean, my mother was great material, so I've used this material in my books. I mean, she was
like poisoning people and things like that.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. But I've always had a sort of feeling of slight bad faith in having, you know, displayed all her foibles to the world. And it becomes even more difficult when I discover that she really was very self-aware and, more than that, really generous to me in ways that I had no idea. That, you know, this was a woman who was very disappointed in her own life. But really had a vision of what life might be for a woman, and that she really wanted my life to be better. And I had no idea that that's how she felt.
And that's what she really bequeathed to you, so to speak, among so many other things. She was a doctor's daughter, and she wanted to be a physician. That was her dream. It's extraordinary that she went off and got a PhD in musicology at the age of, what, 19?
19, yeah.
So obviously an extraordinary young woman, violin, and very smart. Parents went to the trouble of sending her to Switzerland, and yet her father said to her, well, don't become a doctor because you're homely and you're not going to get a husband if you become a doctor.
Right. Just, you know, get, I mean, that, but this is what women went through. I mean, I, one of the things that's so poignant for me is, I mean, he actually says to her, you know, you have a fine mind, but, you know, keep your eye on what's important. And what's important is that you find a husband. And all through these letters, as my mother is getting older and older, her mother is saying, how we pray for you to find Mr. Wright. And there was a full moon last night, and I prayed that this time Mr. Wright will come along. And, you know, the notion that you would do what you wanted to do, follow your dreams, it wasn't in the cards. It was, you know, okay, being a doctor would might work okay if you were pretty, but for an ugly woman, no way, because that's really going to be a barrier.
To have your father tell you that you're an ugly woman, too. I mean, what a message. And she was getting messages even, you know, well into her later years from her parents that she couldn't get out of her head, especially her mother, in fact.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things that I – when I find this letter that my father is – my grandfather wrote to her when she was 16, you know, you're homely – I kept wondering, why did she hang on to this letter? And in fact, I was so angry about it. I have this little writing cabin out in the woods, and I got this letter, and I went out and sort of ritually burned it, which I think my mother should have done when she got it. But instead, she carried it around her whole life because I think it really was a reminder to her of the themes of her life, which were she was smart that it didn't matter. You know, it just that wasn't the important thing for a woman. What mattered was that she, you know, get her MRS.
This is why Betty Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique and why it affected so many women, and it began that next wave of feminism. But it's hard for young women now to realize. I mean, reading your book, I was thinking my sister was in her mid-20s and she was unmarried. And one of the guys in the neighborhood who was a wise ass said, here's Lois and all her spinster friends. I mean, they're in their mid-20s. You know, I mean, it's impossible for young women nowadays to sort of absorb this and realize this. But that's the way it was.
Well, I mean, one of the things that was so generous, I think, for my mother was the day that I was born, she wrote. She didn't keep a diary, but she wrote these sort of scraps of paper that she filed away. And one of the scraps of paper was, no matter what this little girl looks like, I am going to do my best to make sure that she feels pretty. And she developed this sort of revolutionary idea of what beauty was. And I was a horrible adolescent. I think most of us are. I mean, I was fat and my hair was frizzy. And every time I looked in the mirror, I loathed myself. And my mother just kept promising me, when you find out who you are, you will find your own beauty. I promise you, you're going to be beautiful.
She also made you think of, well, being defiant and not necessarily doing what, in fact, this book is an exercise to me in Sartre's notion of bad faith, you know, that you shouldn't follow what other people say you should do. You should follow your own heart and you should be authentic to yourself. It's like existential genuineness or something. And she taught you that.
She absolutely did, because my mother discovered in late middle age that she had spent her whole life chasing her mother's dream, not her dream. And the realization is so horrifying to her. That, you know, here she is, she's almost 50, and she suddenly realized she has never, I mean, she's gotten the PhD in music. She's not musical, but her mother wanted, her mother was musical and had been offered a scholarship to go study in Switzerland, and her parents had made her turn it down to go to work and put her brother through college. So my grandmother gives my mother the opportunity that she herself had wanted, but which my mother didn't want. But my mother dutifully does it, practices the violin 6 hours a day.
Your grandmother, we should mention, was called the Saul Hurech of Cleveland. I mean, she was like an impresario, really.
She was an impresario, but she was an impresario. And that's actually one of the other things that I discovered as I was researching the book. I mean, she had always told us that my grandparents lost everything in the stock market crash. So my grandmother becomes an impresario to help out. And she always said that she gave up her business when the bad times ended because good women didn't work if they didn't have to, because it humiliated their husbands.
Shame their husbands.
Yeah. It made the world feel they couldn't support them. And so she always said that when the war ended, when the Depression ended, she gave up her job. And in fact, what I discovered was she didn't give up the job. It was taken away from her. The guy who had been the Saul Hurock of Cleveland gave it up in 1928 because he didn't think he could make a living during the Depression, bringing culture to Cleveland. And in 1945, he wanted his job back, and he got it back. He just took all the contracts right away from my grandmother. And as his daughter said to me, I expect that my father said to people, well, I have a family to support and she doesn't. But my grandmother fought it and fought it hard. And there are lots of letters from people, you know, Rudolf Serkin, Ezio Pinza, I mean, really important Arthur Rubinstein saying, I'd like to help you, but the pressures are too strong and I can't. And so she obviously fought back, tried to keep her business and couldn't.
There are some big names here. I mean, for people who were living, I suppose, by most standards, what would be considered an ordinary life. I mean, your mother later on, even though it wasn't supposedly appropriate for women to work, actually got a bookstore going and had contact with Clarence Darrow, and Bertrand Russell was in love with her. I mean, there's some wonderful stories here. But what I kept harkening back to in reading the book was the thought that you had all this wealth of material. I mean, it was like I said, you were an archaeologist almost, going back and learning things that you never knew and learning about people that you had sort of fixed in your mind in one way and then they became fluid in a completely different way.
Well, I'm really fortunate in that my mother's family was a family that wrote letters to each other even when they were in the same town. And they also passed them around. So, you know, there would be a letter with my grandmother's handwriting across the top saying, please return. I mean, it's obvious that this was a way, and in a pre-email time, they were sort of forwarding in the way that we do now so that people were staying in touch with each other. And so the wealth of material is really extraordinary. And I was excavating, and excavating is such a great word because like an archaeologist, it wasn't neatly filed. It wasn't like, you know, it went chronologically from 1924 to 1984. It was, you know, I would pick up one piece of paper and it would be in the 20s and then another piece of paper and it would be in the 80s. And it was all just jumbled in with shopping lists and prescriptions for drugs and notes for articles my mother had wanted to
non-linear
write.
Non-linear fragments that had to be assembled by you, yes.
Yes.
What a formidable task that must have been in some ways, and yet fascinating because, you know, as you go through the book, you learn things, and I don't want to give too much away here, but things that you discover. I mean, you discover your father was an ardent lover. There was, by the way, a husband before your father. Your mother did get married, though somewhat late, and you discovered that he was the one that wanted out of the marriage more than your mother did, even though he was insufferable and complaining about her. You imagine Ruth Reichel's mother, a lousy cook, a lousy homemaker, all those kinds of things. I mean, what irony in that, right? But there it is. I mean, those kinds of discoveries are really like eureka. I mean, suddenly everything lights up in a different way.
Well, that's absolutely true. But I think for me, to get back to what you were saying earlier, I mean, one of the really big discoveries was that my mother, having been such a good girl, teaches me defiance. And her message to me over and over and over again is don't do what's expected of you. Do what you want to do and defy me. I mean, her message to me was don't do what I want you to do. And then, of course, when I don't do what she wants me to do, she's furious.
Well, when you publish your first book, I mean, what, cookbook, Ruth? You know, I mean, she's giving you a message, but you realize now that the message could have been sort of inverted in many ways.
Yes. I mean, she was like, you know, she said, you know, do what you want to do. But when that turned out to be writing a cookbook, she said, you know, this is what we sent you to graduate school for. And when I became a restaurant critic, you know, it's like, you know, all you're doing is telling rich people where to go eat. When are you going to do something serious with your
life?
She
believed in service. She really did, didn't she?
Yes. She believed that we were put here to be useful to people. And as she wrote at one point, it's what we're made for. And one of the things that's so heartening about what I discovered is that at the very end of her life, she found out how to be useful and that it saved her.
She also, unfortunately, you mentioned the divorce. She went through that kind of stigma, and because in those days, for a woman to be divorced was certainly to endure a good deal of stigma. And later on, she went through a lot of psychiatric stuff, including a whole pharmacopoeia of just being fed, which is what psychiatrists did to the women who they thought were unsettled or needed medication for whatever the reasons.
Well, one of the really sad things for me is when I found all these prescriptions and I went to medical journals from the 50s and 60s and looked up, you know, what they were doing with Dexedrine, Benzedrine, Elavil. And you look at all of these ads, and the ads are pictures of women surrounded by dishes, dirty dishes, and looking all sad. And the copy says, you know, how to turn your patient into a happy housewife. And then there's another one with a woman vacuuming with a big smile on her face. And it says, you know, Dexedrine will, you know, improve her mood. And, you know, I think
Dexedrine and a good Hoover or something, right?
Exactly.
Tied in with Pomona.
Exactly. But, you know, I mean, in the end, I had this feeling that my mother stood in for so many women of her generation who were so deeply unhappy and disappointed in their lives that they turned it in on themselves. And the social response to that was, well, just give them drugs and put a smile on their faces. And what does it matter that they don't really have work?
Talking with Ruth Reichel, and her new book is Not Becoming My Mother and Other Things She Taught Me Along the Way. Ann Padgett says of this book, Not Becoming My Mother is a work of inestimable love and generosity. By reexamining her mother's life, Ruth Reichel shows us the value of taking another look at the mythologies we have all created. This could be a guidebook for rethinking the lives of an entire generation of women, and it shows us how to do it with kindness and clear-eyed compassion. Sort of like negative example in a way, isn't it?
Well, that was really the most heartbreaking thing for me. There is a point where my mother writes to her psychiatrist, sometimes it will be worth my while to be ridiculous. And I thought, what could she have meant by this? And I realized that, you know, she was bipolar. And her way of dealing with that was to say to me, just because I do ridiculous things doesn't mean that you have to do this. And I realized that she was really leading by negative example. Her whole message to me was, don't become me. You don't have to become me. I am not a model. And I, you know, as a mother myself, I cannot imagine doing that. I mean, I think that more than anything, we want our children's respect. And my mother loved me enough to sabotage my respect to save me. And it just, I mean, even thinking about it now, I find myself starting to cry.
A little far-clamped, as they say on Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
Understandably so. I mean, it really is quite moving. And your mother's story is moving. I mean, another thing that moved me was when your father died, she really became immobilized. She really, you know, went to her bed, as they say, and became quite depressed. And then suddenly she just got up and started getting involved in life again and started doing what she was always kind of made to do, which is to give to other people.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that in she had a friend who was ill, and that's finally what got her out of her own bed, was this woman needed hospice care. And my mother said, come live with me. I'll take care of you. And in caring for her, found her purpose in life and found her own center. And one of the things that's been great for me in, you know, having the book out there now is I've been hearing from some of the people that my mother helped, people I don't know. One woman wrote to me, you know, I was a college student. And I was kind of lost, and your mother took me in, And I'd never known an old lady like her. She was wild. She said, you know, she wore these bright red linen dresses and this wild jewelry. And my family had sort of despaired of me. And she made me like myself. And she said, you know, I remember she'd take me to museums and show me how to look at art. But more than that, once I was very sad about something and your mother took me out and she said, you know, have anything you want. And she said, you know, what I wanted was 3 hot fudge sundaes. And your mother said, that's just fine, dear. Have whatever you want. And she said, I don't know what I would have done without her. And I had, I mean, these are stories that even when I wrote the book, I didn't know.
There are a number of women who also appear in this book. I wanted to know more about them, I must confess. Your mother's friends, Hermine and Flora and Claudia. I mean, I get a sense of them. You do a nice kind of fluent characterization, but I felt like these were women who also had very distinct identities of their time and were very much a part of that whole milieu that you write about here.
Well, Hermine, who was, I mean, she was such a magical person to me when I was young. She was a spinster. And she was this elegant, tall, thin woman who lived in a beautiful apartment. And our apartment was always a mess and it was crowded and small. And she lived in this beautiful, clean apartment that was always filled with flowers. And she had a housekeeper who, you know, changed her sheets every day and kept it impeccable. And the two of them were sort of there. And Hermine was a wonderful cook. So you'd walk in and you'd smell first the flowers and then you'd smell the scent of her baking. And I remember being a little girl and, you know, sort of like following my nose into the kitchen and begging to stay for dinner. And, you know, my mother was always saying,
Even then your olfactory lobes were very sharply attuned.
Oh, yes, especially to good food. Yes. But my mother, every time we would leave, my mother would say, oh, it's such a shame Hermine isn't married. She'd make some man such a wonderful wife. And my mother was always trying to introduce Hermine to a suitable guy. Well, lo and behold, she does introduce her to a guy who falls in love with Hermine, and they get married. And the first time we go to visit Hermine after her marriage, we walk into the apartment, and what I remember is that the smell had changed so much. It's no longer flowers and sugar and butter. Now it's cigar smoke. And it's not so neat, the apartment anymore, because Joe has made her get rid of her housekeeper because, you know, he didn't want a working wife. So Hermine has given up her job. And then he said, you know, he didn't really want some other woman cleaning in the house. And there was no reason why Hermine couldn't do this. And I remember after we left from that visit, my mother, I just shaking herself the whole time we're walking home, just saying, I have never seen Hermine looking so unkempt. And then she sort of asks herself, you know, would it have been better if she hadn't gotten married? And it was clear to me that the answer was yes, and that my mother was regretting having engineered this marriage.
I'm talking, if you just joined us, with Ruth Reichel. She's now editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, many years New York Times restaurant critic. I used to say our friend Frank Rich was the butcher of Broadway. Ruth was a woman who managed to, well, like Michael Bauer here in town, help many restaurants and perhaps maybe hurt many restaurants. She had that kind of power. She's also the author now of Not Becoming My Mother and Other Things She Taught Me Along the Way. And you can join us if you have something you'd like to add to this conversation, please do. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and you are welcome to join us here with Ruth Reichel, famed restaurant and food critic, and now the editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine and author of a book called Not Becoming My Mother and Other Things She Taught Me Along the Way. And our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius XM satellite. It's 866-733-6786, so feel free to join the program. You can also send an email to us, forum@kqed.org, and it's a little bit sobering to realize that Ruth left us here in the Bay Area, abandoned us. 1984.
Yes,
a quarter of a century ago.
Oh my! I mean, you had to say that, right?
Well, sometimes you must wonder why did I leave, right?
I all the time, and you know, being here this weekend, the weather's been so spectacular. Everybody here seems to have such a lovely life. I do wonder what I'm doing back in that cold, mean city.
Well, let's get some of our callers on here with you and from the warmth of San Mateo. Brooke, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, Michael. Ruth, I just want to let you know how much we love your work, and I've kind of taught my kids how to cook. My mom taught me how to cook through Gourmet, and I've taught my kids how to cook through it. You know, it has such beautiful pictures, and then you're able to create as a family what you see in there. But my question is a little bit, may sound like a little bit of a silly one. Have you heard the comment that the critic makes in the movie Ratatouille about being a food critic?
I saw the movie, but you're going to have to refresh my memory.
Oh, I guess what I would say is that anybody who likes the field should really watch it and just take that little comment, because what he says is so beautiful about the power of critics and how they so like to be able to throw it around and make someone succeed or make them fail, and how in the end it really is the cooks and the chefs and the restaurants who make this world for us, and the critics are just players in the game. But the way he says it is so beautiful and touching, and it's not what you would expect from a kid's movie. So I just wanted to see if you'd
I'm glad you brought that up, Brooke, because I had made that reference to Frank Rich and all, but what about the power of the restaurant critic? I know you've been asked that before. You want to comment?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's no question that, you know, it's definitely the cooks and the restaurateurs. I mean, not just the cook, but the whole experience of the restaurant that's the important thing. But I think that there are two ways of being a restaurant critic. And one way is just being a consumer reporter. So you're telling people how to spend their money, which was never what I wanted to do. I think what a good critic does, whether it's a food critic or a theater critic or a book critic, is help people appreciate the experience more fully. And I think that if you write a restaurant review in the way that it should be written, people take what you've said and experience the restaurant more fully. You give them the tools to appreciate what they're eating. And I've always tried to do that and to also take my readers along, because the other thing that I always knew as a restaurant critic is that most of the readers aren't going to go there. You know, most of the readers are, this is going to be the one place where they touch the restaurant. So my goal was always to put them in that seat with me and to make them feel as if they were at the restaurant tasting the food. And that's very different than just saying, yes, it's good, no, it's not good. And for a writer, people love reading restaurant reviews. So it's just a way of engaging readers.
Your mother must have been proud of you, ultimately. I mean, didn't she express that to you? Because you did become, you know, you have become sort of, you know, the top of the heap in terms of restaurant reviewers.
Well, she did not live to see me go to the New York Times, which I think would have made her very happy. And I think she was proud of me, but I also think that she sincerely thought that I was throwing my talent away.
Did she give you advice about dating and marriage?
Not conscious. I mean, her advice was, you don't have to get married. And when I got married, I mean, I was the earliest of my friends to get married.
Tell me, by the way, why did you get married on a highway?
Because my first husband was doing road art. Oh. And they were building Route 7, which opened right near my parents' house in Connecticut. And it opened the next week. And we had the opportunity to get married on this unfinished highway. And it seemed perfect. It was a performance piece.
Certainly sounded like it. You know, and I was also thinking in reading your book that even though you make fun of your mother to some extent as a homemaker and as a cook, in fact, the first story you tell, I won't spoil it, but, you know, is about her whipping something together, and a very funny story. But she did the Homemaker's Encyclopedia. And so in some ways, there is a kind of connection there, isn't there?
Well, I mean, the thing that is hilarious, my parents published this 12-volume set of the Homemaker's Encyclopedia, which had, I mean, my mother couldn't sew. I never saw my mother sew anything, but there's an entire volume on sewing. There's a volume on gardening. There's a volume on cooking. There's a volume on etiquette. And the thing that's even more hilarious about it is that this encyclopedia now has a cult following among the religious right, who think of my mother as a domestic goddess. And of course, you know, as she said to me, I don't really know anything about any of these things, but I'm very good at research. So she just researched it all and put it together.
What do you think she would have thought about this following that she has now?
I think she would have thought it was hilarious.
We go to a caller in Nebraska. Cole, where are you in Nebraska?
I'm in Norfolk.
Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Ruth, first of all, I just want to say it's been delightful listening to you for the past, I don't know, hour that you've been on. My question is sort of relating a modern issue that women are facing with an issue that your mother faced when she had the job, like the example that you give during World War II. My question is, do you think that there is the same amount of stress or pressure on young women to fit into a certain role as there was on women such as your mother to fit the homemaker role?
Well, it's a great question. And one of the things that has been really sad to me is, as I talk about this book, is I thought that we had moved farther than we have. And so many young women have come up to me afterwards and said, I am your mother. And the choices that we give women today are, yes, you can have it all, but you can have it at a price. You can be a mother, you can have a fulfilling career, but you can also forget about sleeping for about 20 years. And, you know, one woman, I mean, I've heard from women from all over the spectrum on this, from one woman who said, you know, she had decided when her children were born to give up an enormous career and to go home and raise her children. And now 10 years later, she thinks she made a terrible mistake and it's too late for her to do anything about it. And from another young woman who just looked at me and she said, you know, I look at people like you and I think, I don't want to be Superwoman. I don't think that that's a good choice. And I really think that we in this country have yet to come to terms with the fact that most families have two working parents. And we do not have social policy that helps women with this. And so, yes, I think, you know, the kind of pressures that my mother had, which were, you know, be a good girl, don't get a job, you know, just get married. That particular pressure doesn't exist anymore. But it's been replaced with equally difficult pressures.
And thank you for your call, Cole. In fact, when there was a period, and I'm sure you remember it, when feminism seemed to be preaching almost, you know, that you should not necessarily just accept this wife-mother life, as Kate Chopin would call it. You know, you should, in fact, have an independence that became, for some women, almost oppressive because some women wanted to be just, quote, wife-mothers. You know, they didn't want to necessarily go out and be something or didn't feel that they were made to be something else.
Well, I mean, I think for people, for those people, the choices today are much easier because, you know, if you feel like you have the choice and what you want to do is just be a wife mother, there's a lot of support for it. But maybe I'll hear from someone who says I'm dead wrong about that.
We need the sociology statistics here. We actually, in fact, have done some programs on this, and sort of depends on who's doing the research. We need your mother. She was a researcher. We got a caller up in Petaluma. Joan, good morning.
Hi. I'm calling. I want to first thank Ruth for her wonderful books. I've enjoyed Tender at the Bone so much. My daughters, age 30 and 27, gave me your Not Turning Into Your Mother book yesterday for Mother's Day. So I think it's the quintessential present. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
What I wanted to say was that a few years ago when my mother was still alive, I ran a informal writing group, and with a group of about five of the ladies she lived with in a small residence, all over the age of 80, we reflected on memories of their mother. And I was so surprised, really, that these elderly women said, all of them were saying, I think of my mother every day. And it made me realize how mothers are our teachers all during our lives, even after they're long gone. And I wanted Ruth to comment on that.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, that our relationship, I don't think just with our mothers, I think with our fathers as well, I think with our parents, is a relationship that you have your entire life. And it's a relationship that goes on long after they've passed away. And, you know, for me, one of the things that was difficult about writing this book was to meet my real mother, not the mother that I manufactured for myself, but the real woman, the woman who was not my mother, but was herself a vibrant woman, made me feel that I had really missed something enormous in not having known her when she was alive, and made me very sad that I couldn't have a living relationship with her, that now this relationship with this remarkable person is totally one-sided because now it's all in my head.
But it's still a relationship. I mean, you got to know her in ways that have brought her back alive. I mean, it's almost like what a novelist does. I mean, you're creating it out of the whole cloth of your imagination and what you've been feeding it. And it came, in fact, at a very curious time. I mean, just in terms of benchmarks, it was like around the 100th birthday, which would have been her 100th birthday.
It was on her 100th birthday that I went and looked at all of these letters, yes.
And these pictures are wonderful. I mean, the photograph on them, it's almost as if, you know, there's a Yiddish word that comes to mind, kfel. She's looking down at you, the little girl, and she's looking, like, beaming at you while you're... I'm not sure what you're doing. You may be doing something with food.
I was eating.
It looks
yes,
like,
was,
yeah, which is appropriate. And then there's a picture on the back where you're kind of reaching up to her and she's looking down at you and the stroller is nearby and you can't even see your mother's face, but she's got one of these big hats on and one of these kind of mink-type jackets that women wore in those days.
And she's so chic.
She's very chic, yeah.
Yes.
We go to another Petaluma caller. That's you, Marlena. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Ruth, I just wanted to tell you, I also really love Tender at the Bone, and my father was the cook in our family. My mother was a professional woman. He was also, you know, work full-time, but I ended up going to culinary school in 83, graduated in 84 from the Culinary Academy in the city. And when we were passing Tender at the Bone back and forth and laughing like crazy about your stories about the little things in the refrigerator that your mother had in there.
Uh-huh.
My dad was famous for that. We used to call them his science experiments. He was a biochemist. So if you reached into the back of his refrigerator, you could pull very frightening things out. And he had a tendency to just carve off whatever was on the outside and then feed us that food. And when I said to him, Dad, Ruth's mother is just like you. He looked at me and he absolutely could not make that connection whatsoever. He just said, I don't do that. That, you know, he laughed like mad about her and didn't see it in himself. But, you know, I just wanted to tell you how much it meant to the two of us. He died 2 years ago, and my tribute to him in my life was to become a chef. So,
do you work in a restaurant now?
I'm retired now. My body kind of gave out. You know how hard that is. So I still love to cook. I still read recipes like mad. I've read all of your books. And, you know, when I'm cooking, sometimes I have a picture of my dad up in the kitchen and I just look at him. And, you know, sometimes I think about the best memory I have of him is cooking with him eating.
It's really interesting because I do think one of the great things about cooking is every time you go into the kitchen, all the people that you've cooked with are sort of standing there with you.
Mm-hmm.
And it is like a gateway, at least for me, it is a kind of gateway into memory.
Sorry, Lawrence Durrell said that about sex, too, that every time you make love, there are like about eight people in the room, you know, maybe your parents, who knows who else it is. I'm struck, though, by just... Well, I'm thinking of a book by Nancy Friday, which you probably know, called My Mother, Myself, which was published many years ago. And, of course, you were so different than your mother, and you became, you know, the whole premise of the book is why I didn't become my mother, or how my mother served as an example for me not to become her. And yet, when you went out there and you had to disguise yourself, because people knew you as Ruth Reichel by sight in those restaurants, you disguised yourself as your mother.
I did become my mother, yes.
I mean, I don't know what a psychoanalyst would do with that, but, you know, it does seem striking to me, doesn't it?
Well, you know, it was just an easy one to do. You know, I had her clothes, and I, you know, knew who she was, so it was a very easy disguise to do. If I wanted to do an old lady, you know, and I mean, the truth is I do look a lot like my mother, although I didn't know it till I turned into her physically. And I actually hadn't made the connection until a couple days ago that, you know, I've written this book, Not Becoming My Mother, but I did become my mother. And I don't know where to go with that either.
Well, that's maybe we have to lie down on the couch and talk about for a while. But here's a question for you from a woman named Katrina. She says, I recently purchased a copy of Gourmet as a result of an article about the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Is that pronounced?
Yeah, Immokalee, yes.
Immokalee Workers. I'm not a cook, but I do care about the social justice issues at the heart of our food system and was delighted at the coverage she gave this organization of tomato pickers. Was this article well received? And does Ms. Reichel intend to continue articles of this nature and sustainability in general, in addition to the general gourmet coverage this magazine is known for? Thank you.
Well, actually, this was far from the first of these kinds of social issue articles. I mean, we've been doing these ever since I was at the magazine. This one is the one that has gotten by far the most play. I mean, it's a shocking story of how these tomato workers in Florida are virtual slaves. And one of the things that has been so gratifying is not only that it was very well received. I mean, with the exception of a few people who said, you know, keep this stuff out of our magazine. But, you know, overwhelmingly, it was very well received. But as a result of this article, the governor of California met with the Coalition of Workers and things.
Governor of California?
The governor of Florida. Yeah. Where Immokalee is. The governor of Florida agreed to meet with the workers. They've been trying to get a meeting with him for 4 years, and he, as a result of this article, met with them, and I think things will change. So, you know, if you needed any impetus to keep going with these kinds of articles, and I would say to the caller, if you go to gourmet.com, we have a section of it called Politics of the Plate. And we put up new material almost every day about sustainability, about government issues.
Is this more your mother's influence or living in Berkeley?
Living in Berkeley. I'm a Berkeley girl.
I know. And by the way, Katrina, who sent you this email, says, I finished the new book about her mother yesterday and thoroughly loved it, as I have all of Ruth Reichel's books. So it's nice. Let me get another caller on here, and that's you, Shannon, from San Diego. Hi.
Hi. I had an observation I've noticed on the show, a comment being made a couple of times referring to just a wife and mother, and I think that's a pervasive stereotype in our society that it's an easier job. And having given up a nice career to come with my kids, I can attest that it's vastly more difficult than having a regular career.
I couldn't agree with you more.
And
I
mean, likewise.
It is the hardest work there is. The question is, once your kids grow up, where does that leave you?
And well, in my case, it's helped me reexamine what I want to do with my life and follow my passion rather than just a lucrative high-tech career that, you know, I'm not really passionate about. So I can certainly continue working on that while I'm with my kids.
Sounds like you've made made the right choice, Shannon.
Sounds like you've made the perfect choice.
Yeah. And good luck to you, and thank you. We've got a caller from Brooklyn. Erin, hi.
Hi. So, Ruth, I just wanted to let you know that reading your book sort of reawakened a love to read for me. I've never really been much of a reader, but always wanted to, and reading your books, I started from the beginning, somebody gave them to me, and I just went all through them like nobody's business. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
Her mother would have been proud of that.
Absolutely. I'm proud of that.
And also, I'm a food photographer in Brooklyn, And you've really inspired me as a woman who started out in the food business and, you know, especially reading, you know, your books and sort of thinking about how you started out. Do you think it's much harder for women today who want to break into the food world than it was when you started out?
Well, I would say that the answer is yes and no.
It's harder for photographers in general, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, but
there's so many food blogs and everything that it's much more competitive.
It's more competitive, but there's also, I mean, people are interested in food. When I started out, I mean, I was lucky in that nobody else wanted any of these jobs that I got. But there really weren't a lot of outlets. And today, you know, Epicurean magazines are proliferating like crazy. There are food blogs. I mean, food is really an important part of popular culture. And, you know, 30 years ago, that just was not the case. So although it's harder to break in, there are a lot more places that are available to you.
This is true. Well, it's my dream to publish photos in Gourmet magazine. I love your photography. I had one photo in Gourmet once.
Good luck to you, Erin, and thank you so much for the call. And you're listening to Forum. We are talking to Ruth Reichel. This is Pledge Week for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we go to more calls. We go to Knoxville, Tennessee. Kevin, good morning.
Hi there. Well, I'm not going to say what I started out to say because I was reminded that my mother taught me to cook when I was 6 years old by handing me a package of Jell-O. And she did that with my three siblings. And as we grew older, she kept upping the ante. If you want brownies for dessert, here's the box. Make them. And we got to the point where she had us making entire meals for the family in exchange for not having to do the dishes on our night. And at the age of 51, a career as a computer programmer and programming magazine editor came to an end, and looking around for something else to do, I ended up becoming a chef and food writer. My mother started it when I was six.
Started with that Jell-O, huh?
You're very lucky.
Started with a Jell-O.
Well, thank you for that narrative. Appreciate hearing from you this morning. Again, that's Kevin from Knoxville. And we go to Gary in, wait a minute. Gary in Burlingame. I'm not, for some reason, I've got a problem punching that call up. So we'll try to see if we can remedy that and do it. What's it like being editor-in-chief, though? You've been how long at that post?
10 years.
Yeah.
A long time.
Very different than what you were doing before, huh?
It's great. I mean, it's very collaborative work. And there's something so exciting about working with a group of people that you really love, really talented people. And you build an idea together. You know, you take an idea and you toss it around, and everybody has some way to make it better. And it's very exciting, and you know, making the magazine into something that is not only beautiful and delicious, and you know, makes recipes that are really useful to people, but also has a social conscience, has been really exciting.
Magazine business in general, though, we were talking about the photography business before. The internet has hurt it. You know, you can just get things off of the photography logs now and so forth. But the magazine business also has been struggling.
All media.
Advertising,
All media is struggling. And it's very odd because, you know, circulation-wise, we've never been stronger. You know, it's like we're at an all-time high, and I think people really want to know about cooking today. People are going back to their kitchens. So that's been great. But, you know, advertising is very challenged for everyone. It has nothing to do with how much people like the magazine. It's just people are pulling back on advertising budgets. And, you know, newspapers are being hit. Magazines are being hit. We're having to be more efficient, leaner.
Did you have layoffs at Gourmet or not?
We had very few, but we did have some layoffs, yes.
And what about you now? I mean, this is a kind of different turn for you. Are you going to go back to writing about food? Are you moving in a different direction, do you think, or what?
Well, we there's a lot on my plate at the moment. In addition to Gourmet and Gourmet.com and Gourmet's Diary of a Foodie, which is in its third season on PBS, we're shooting a new Gourmet TV show this summer that takes me to cooking schools all over the world. We have a big new gourmet cookbook coming out in September, and we have a cookie book coming out in December. Wow. So there's a lot going on, and I'm working on a novel in my spare time.
Boy, you and Ed Wilson, who was just on with us the last hour, just finished a novel. I wrote a whole book about why I didn't become a novelist, and I'm not working on a novel yet, but maybe there's hope somewhere down the line. You mentioned foodies, though. You know, we just had Michael Pollan on last week, and how much does that whole, you know, slow food movement and Alice Waters, again, whom I'm sure you knew in Berkeley, and how much is that affecting the whole world of Gourmet magazine, or is it?
It's affecting the world of food in general. I mean, enormously. We are becoming mindful cooks, and it's a wonderful and exciting thing to see. And when I look at my son's generation, I think that we're going to see enormous changes down the road. I mean, I think that these kids are really, really thinking thoughtfully about what we eat, how we eat, why we eat what we eat. They are very willing to be less greedy in eating up, you know, more than our share of the world's resources. They are angry about confinement animal facilities. They are, I mean, really, really looking at cooking. I mean, my son got to college, lost 15 pounds in his first semester, and said, you know, I'm going to cook. And, you know, has turned himself into a really serious cook because he wants to eat good food.
We've got seconds left, but is your son defying you? Is he going off on an independent course? And
I sure hope so. I sure hope
you
so.
You nurtured that? You did what Mim did for you?
I sure tried.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you. And again, Ruth Reichel's new book is out. It's called Not Becoming My Mother and Other Things She Taught Me Along the Way. It's a fun and a very illuminating read. Thank you again, Ruth, for being with us.
It's always great to see you.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Tina Lauerberg, Kevin Guillory, and Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Howard Gelman, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thank you for being with us. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.